And welcome back to Fully Equipped, Golf.com's gear-focused podcast where we take PGA Tour news and relate it to the everyday player. I'm Tim Breon, Senior Vice President of TruSpec Golf, joined by Jonathan Wall, Managing Editor for Equipment for Golf.com. Jonathan, what's up, buddy?
Professor, or I'm going to guess you're still on the road?
You know it. I'm in Boston today. Dreary Boston.
Man, that is just wild. You are literally never home. It is crazy. I keep trying to think that I'm going to catch you for one of these pods where you're actually from home base, but yeah.
It'll come soon. We're going to shut it down here. I'm going to head out to San Diego later in the week, and then I'll be home through... Actually, no, I won't be. I'll be heading to New York, Pinehurst, and then Southern California.
Racking up those frequent flyer miles, for sure.
Man, I get a bunch of them, that's for sure. But it's always good to be back here in Boston. We have a TruSpec studio here. It's actually one of our coolest studios, just from a design and layout standpoint. And I spent some time working here in the Boston area at the Country Club in Brookline. Was also the manager out at a private club in Martha's Vineyard. So it's great to see familiar faces, catch up with some folks, and see some family. But in any event, we've got a cool episode lined up here. Kind of a ball-focused episode, actually. Tour topic that we'll get into here. Russell Henley, unfortunately, hit the eject button after playing a ball that he shouldn't have. We've also got a Matt Kuchar ball switch. Be interested to get your take and exactly what's going on with that. Cobra just introduced their Speed Zone product line to the world here recently, so we'll cover a little bit about Speed Zone launch. Got a couple of mailbag questions, and going to get David Orr on the pod. David Orr is a world-renowned putting coach, really close friend of mine. We had a chance to sit down at the Golf Magazine Top 100 Teacher Summit last week in Pinehurst. He and I go back a while, and this is an interview you definitely want to tune in for. David's got some great insights on putting, so should be a great episode. Jonathan, what do you have for us?
You know, an interesting one here for Russell Henley, and I think this kind of just goes to speak to one of the things that I would say tour players in particular have to worry about, which is playing by the one ball rule. You know, it seems really easy. You know, in Russell Henley's case, he plays titles Pro V1X, actually plays this 2017 model of it. And, you know, one ball rule, meaning that once you go out and play a competitive round with a 2017 Pro V1X, you got to play the same ball throughout the entire round. Well, Russell ran into a little bit of an issue because he had the Pro V1X dash version in the bag as well. And that's where we run into this one ball issue. Russell noticed at one point that he was using the dash version and ended up incurring an 8-stroke penalty because he was using a different version. And look, let's kind of figure, you know, people are going to say, well, what's the dash version? Actually, the dash version is now available at retail. You know, this used to be a tour version of the golf ball. I would say, man, Tim, I'd probably say 80 or 90% of recreational golfers. Maybe that's a little bit too high, but I would say it's pretty close. Would probably not notice a difference between the regular Pro V1X and the Pro V1X dash. And the
Agreed.
The real difference here is that the dash version of this golf ball is going to have a similar launch to the standard Pro V1X, so a high launch to kind of get that drop and stop that golfers are looking for, but it's going to have less spin. And this is just simply a recipe that some tour players find to be a benefit to them. Lucas Glover and Jimmy Walker have used the dash version. I believe Luke Donald maybe has even used that version in the past. So, you know, there's been a handful of guys. But, yeah, use the dash version. Didn't realize it until it was too late, and that was kind of his demise.
Couple of remarks on this. First of all, much credit to Russell for this. There's no way that his playing competitors or anybody else would have known, except for he and his caddy, that he was playing the dash ball. The difference, you know, as far as the graphics is, you almost can't even see it. You know, a lot of folks will mark their golf ball to identify it as theirs, and a lot of the marks will go across the seam or across the label, which would end up hiding the dash. So A lot of respect goes out to Russell for being a player of honor and bringing himself forward for violating the one ball rule. You know, as far as what your comment about most amateur golfers probably not noticing a difference, I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah.
With a lot of golf ball technology, you know, most of the technology in golf balls has to be activated through speed, meaning club head speed has to be high enough for the player to actually start experiencing a difference in performance. Obviously, most players don't have enough speed to activate some of these differences. You know, I like what Titleist is doing here. There have been a few different versions available of different golf balls, you know, within the Titleist product line to the tour player. We all know that when you're looking at some of the marquee players, that they may be playing versions of golf balls that are different from all of the other players on tour. And just the fact that Titleist is offering an option to the consumers, similar to what they're doing to the tour players, you know, I give them a lot of credit for that. As far as the performance characteristics of the dash ball, my understanding is that it flies a little bit higher, but still maintains lower spin. Is that
yeah,
safe
yeah. So
to say?
It's yep. So it's lower spinning than the V1X ball, the standard version. But yeah, they said, you know, pretty much similar in the launch department. It's just guys. Again, we're talking about tour players here, players who, are able to discern things with a golf ball that the average golfer just can't pick up on. And you know, Titleist, I mean, look, Titleist is never gonna, people I think believe that Titleist just has a million different versions of golf balls out on the market. They really don't. It's like three, I believe it's like three or four versions. And a couple of them just happen to be tour only versions. You know, it's if they were to give every you know, player out on tour their own golf ball recipe, it would just be a complete disaster, because trying to keep track of all those and trying to get them out on the production line, it would be crazy. So, you know, credit to them for kind of sticking to their guns. But, you know, I think that's great, because again, you know, I think recreational golfers just assume that tour players are using something that they can't play, when in actuality, large majority of the guys out on tour are using the V1 or the V1X that you or I could go pick up from our local golf shop.
Yeah, and I remember spending time with Titleist a couple of years back. You know, we've discussed on the pod before the way some players take to certain vintages of ball or certain year production models. But the interesting conversation a couple of years back with the folks from Team Titleist is that they were starting to limit their access to some of those versions, those variant versions of the ball, and really only make them available for their marquee players. So if you were, you know, ranked 110th in the world and you happen to like the 2009 Pro V or Pro VX, you may have a tougher time getting your hands on that specific year version of the ball. So
just go to eBay. I'm pretty sure they could find some.
Yeah, right. Or just go to Jonathan's bag. I'm sure he found one in the woods.
Yes. No, exactly. I probably have a couple of those. I should actually go sift through and see if I can find an original OG Pro V1. I'm sure I have one of those sitting around here somewhere.
So that leads us into tour topic number two for the week, which is the ball change that Matt Kuchar made. Matt Kuchar has obviously been a strong advocate and endorsing the Bridgestone ball brand for quite a long time. Bridgestone makes an amazing golf ball, first and foremost. Let's just put that out there. I think that they fly under the radar. Obviously, signing Tiger Woods a couple years back was a huge score for them.
It was the ball Tiger used for pretty much his entire time at Nike. I mean, he even admitted it. It was a Bridgestone-designed golf ball that you know, had a Nike stamp on it. So, but Bridgestone was still producing the balls for Nike during Tiger's incredible run during, 2000. So yeah,
Bridgestone's always produced an amazing golf ball. I mean, when they first started to really pop on the ball scene many years ago, remember the Rexstar golf ball that they had out?
Yeah.
Yeah. That thing was amazing. I actually have a Rexstar sitting somewhere in my collection of golf gear. It was a Rexstar that Nick Faldo hit in the water on the 18th hole at Doral.
Did you go dive in after it?
Oh, hell yeah. I followed right in, because the reason why was because what he did immediately following hit that shot in the water. He ended up going on to win the event, and he hit a 4-wood from like 235 yards, 240 yards on the 18th hole at Doral, which is an extremely difficult hole. For years, it ranked as the toughest hole out on tour, actually. Toughest par four, anyways. And he hits this four wood from 235 yards out to like 4 feet, makes the putt, wins the event. And I was like, I need that golf ball. So, but the real reason I went there is I wanted to see what golf ball he was playing. I mean, I think I was 12 or 13 years old at the time, but I guess I've always been a bit of a gear geek when it came to golf gear. But in any event, they've been making great golf balls for a really long time. They've kind of pioneered cover technology with polyurethane covers. And all this technology, you know, nowadays they're offering a multitude of different products. We see some really exceptional players beyond just Tiger Woods playing their golf ball. And what do you have for us when it comes to the Kuchar prototype that he was testing? I think it's the same one that Bryson DeChambeau actually was testing out as well.
It is, yeah. It's the new Tour BX prototype. And I think, you know, there are some prototypes, I will say, and I kind of go back to Ping's Blueprint Irons. You know, those were a prototype for basically a year before they came to retail. So there are some occasions where a prototype will hang around tour for a longer period of time. But, you know, for the most part, when you start to see things pop up on tour, there's a pretty good chance it's coming to retail soon. And look, we're in launch season right now. PGA merchandise show is just around the corner. You know, this golf ball is coming to retail. So I think that's the exciting part here is that what the tour players are seeing is probably a little bit of a preview of what you or I could probably see when we go out and test this golf ball. And again, I'm really excited to test this one. I've been hearing about it, no joke, going all the way back to last year at the PGA merchandise show. I was talking to Bridgestone about another product that they just launched, and they said, you know, we're really excited about this product, but we are, you know, once you see what we have coming for the new Tour B, I think you're going to be blown away. What we're seeing during testing has really opened our eyes to kind of basically crashing through that ceiling. You know, I think, again, with a lot of tech, people always think, well, what kind of noticeable gains can we get? And I think this new golf ball is just it further shows that there are some huge gains to be made especially in the ball department. You know, Bryson DeChambeau goes out, switches golf balls, and finds an additional 750 RPMs of spin around the green. 750 RPMs.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of spin, Tim. And I go back to, you know, the spin that I saw with Callaway's Mac Daddy wedge. You know, that's, we're talking about grooves here and an aggressive design for a club. This is a golf ball that's helping generate 750 RPMs of spin. That is a lot.
Food for thought, switch to an MD5 wedge with this Bridgestone prototype, and you could create 1800 RPMs more spin. That's
a little different. That's scary. You'd be sucking every golf ball off the green. I do not advocate that. Let me just put it that way. but again, this highlights the benefits that two different golfers can find in one golf ball. Bryson finds 750 RPMs of spin. Kuchar tests the golf ball and he finds an additional 10.5 yards off the tee. Now,
ball speed was faster, wasn't it?
Ball speed was faster. It was only about a mile and a half. And you know, people were asking me when I mentioned this on Twitter, you know, a mile and a half, not noticeable gains. But again, we're talking tour players. These guys are looking at their equipment to try and squeeze every possible mile per hour of ball speed, every possible yard out of their gear to make sure it's completely, you know, maximized and designed just for their swing characteristics. So it equates to about an additional 4 yards a carry. And then with rollout, he was consistently seeing 10 and a half yards. Now, he's not going to get the same rollout every time, but still 10 and a half yards is pretty impressive.
One less club.
Exactly. Especially for a guy who ranked 247th out of 248 guys on tour and driving distance last year. Now, Cooch won twice. He had a couple of runner-up finishes. I mean, it was probably one of his best years ever on tour, but you know, when you're averaging 276 off the tee, anytime you can get more distance, you're right. You know, that's one less club in. That's a huge benefit. He also saw a couple hundred RPMs more spin, not as much as Bryson, which again goes to show you that Bryson saw a benefit with the short game spin, whereas Cooch, I think, saw a benefit more off the tee. And this goes to show you that golf balls nowadays, you know, years and years ago, I'd say probably a decade ago, you know, it was tough to try and decouple speed and spin. You know, you were either getting one or the other. Where with nowadays, with a lot of these golf balls, they are able to find ways to give you the ball speed and low spin off the tee. But when you get around the green, you're getting a lot of that high spin that you need for those drop and stop shots. So yeah, I you know, Cooch and Bryson are already in it. I'm positive that Tiger is switching into this golf ball very soon. And look, I think this is probably going to be one of the most talked about golf balls as we head into the meat of launch season.
If you ask a lot of equipment experts, what has really evolved the most when you're talking about equipment over the last 15, 20, 25 years?
Golf balls.
And when you're talking about, you know, what has made the game change so radically and what could be done to the equipment to limit the evolution of the game so that these long hitters are not just bombing and gouging it out of the rough. And, you know, they've obsoleted most of these classic golf courses and they have to shove tee boxes way back on some of these holes and start doing some things to trick these golf courses up just to make them relevant. A lot of it, if you ask most equipment experts, has to do with the golf ball. Of course, driver technology's gotten better. When you went to the larger 460cc designs, when they started to really address COR and then CT and ball speed started to go up, of course, that's going to help things as far as maximizing performance. You know, we've seen a proliferation in technology as it pertains to irons in the last few years, last 15 years or so. We've seen some of this technology start to affect putting and wedge play as well. But the one thing I think that clearly is the biggest difference as far as performance is the golf ball. Case in point, it's hard to get your hands on them these days, but go out and get your hands on a sleeve of Titleist Tour Bellotta 100s or Tour Bellotta 90s and go out and play.
Oh man, and you're gonna so much.
Your score will be radically different. I'll almost guarantee it because they were so different. They were so much softer. They spun ridiculously.
You're gonna need a pallet of those golf balls, Tim. Speaking of golf ball pallets, if you go out and play, seriously, I mean, you probably remember this. That Tour Bellotta, all it took was one swipe with the wedge, and you had completely taken off like half the cover of that ball. If you caught one clean.
Did you ever cut one apart and light it on fire?
Wait. No, I usually would with professionals, I would always get out the liquid core and I would use that as a bouncy ball and then cut it open and just watch it just go everywhere. But no, okay, I need, tell me about this one.
So as a kid, you know, being a mischievous kid,
you're still mischievous.
We would put a slice in the cover and then we would get a match and get a, you know, match burning red hot, maybe get a couple of them. And shove them into the little slice, and then those Bellotta windings would start to incinerate and smoke. And eventually, when it would get to the inner core, that liquid core, I don't know what was happening chemically, but those things would explode like a cherry bomb. And we used to light these Bellottas on fire, and you know, we used to do interesting things.
Well, I know what I'm doing this weekend. I'm going to go find some of those golf balls and have a science experiment with my kids. So
yeah, it was crazy stuff that we used to do as kids. But yeah, I mean, the golf ball has changed radically over the last 20 years. It has really changed the game of golf. You know, you ask different folks out there what can be done to limit this, you know, this evolution of the game and make the courses more relevant and without having to change them. And a lot of folks say limit the golf ball. Obviously, that would have huge ramifications if you made the golf ball uniform out on the PGA Tour. Some of the companies wouldn't mind it as much. Other companies, it would be enormously detrimental to their business. So I don't see there ever being a day where they would make the golf ball uniform or limit the ball, but who knows? You know, bottom line
they could do bifurcation. I don't know. I'm kind of of the belief that, you know, I think eventually we're probably going to get there.
I've got no problem with the bifurcation of the equipment rules. I have no problem with it. Yeah. Make the game easier for the amateurs. They do it in other sports, and it hasn't negatively impacted. You know, when you look at baseball with them using aluminum and composite material bats in amateur baseball and then wooden bats in professional baseball. There are a lot of other games that, you know, have different sets of equipment depending upon if you're playing amateur or professional athletics. So I have no problem with it. But I think the biggest takeaway from all of this discussion about golf balls is that if you're somebody that likes gear and somebody that believes that the gear matters and you're not paying attention to the golf ball, you're leaving out a huge piece of the equation. So at least, you know, maybe you may not have access to a club fitter to help you work through this, or a professional that can help you work through this, but take an unbiased approach, test a bunch of different models from a bunch of different brands, focus on the short game first, and then once you've whittled it down to a couple of selections that are good for the short game, then get back and see what happens on the long game. And at the end of that process, you're going to end up selecting a golf ball, which is definitely going to help you score better. And it's going to impact your scoring and enjoyment. So really important point to make there. Don't leave out the golf ball when you're looking at the importance of gear. And with that, I think it's would be good to get into the gear spotlight for the week, which is the Cobra Speed Zone product line that was just introduced. We got to see it over in Korea and you in the player testing that was done in Scottsdale. Just speaking about the driver product, really good product. I mean, it's really cool looking, number one, but it's a really, really good product out there. Cobra has kind of flown under the radar, in my opinion, for quite some time now. We spoke on last week's pod about T.O. coming over from the TaylorMade team to help them engineer and design some different products and how their driver design has gotten better and better and better. You know, they've gone to the CNC milling in their face. Now they've actually wrapped that face up beyond just the regular weld lines on the frame. It's a really cool product, and what we saw at a performance, Jonathan, was outstanding. You know, share with our listeners what you saw in player testing, and then obviously how that backed up and supported what we saw in robotic testing.
Yeah, I mean, briefly, I want to ask you a question here. Every year, I feel like there are probably two or three drivers that are kind of the most talked about in the equipment industry. I'm venture to say that this will probably end up being one of the most talked about in that two or three. Would you agree?
Definitely, 100%. I would say that Cobra drivers, with the exception of maybe 1 year, if we go back 7 or 8 years, Cobra's been producing one of the best three drivers of all of these years, except for maybe one of them.
Yeah, I mean, F9 was really impressive in my eyes.
Yeah, F9 was amazing. F6 was amazing. LTD was amazing. The Fly Z was hands down the best driver product in the marketplace that specific year. And so, you know, for folks that haven't tried a Cobra driver, you're missing out, number one. No, it doesn't mean that it's going to fit every player. Obviously, you need to make sure that it's properly fit, and you may find another head out there that's a little bit better, but I'll guarantee you that if you try 7 or 8 different brands and 7 or 8 different products, that one of these Cobra Speed Zone or Speed Zone Extreme products will end up being one of the top three that you end up looking at.
No, so, I totally agree with you there. I think Cobra is starting to make some serious noise, especially in the driver department. And look, I think every year that's probably the most talked about club that people want to know what's going on with is the driver. You know, iron technology sure has changed a lot, especially in the last few years with the hollow construction. And now that they're filling it with different materials, but you know, everybody wants to know if they can gain, you know, 10 yards by putting a new driver in play. And it seems to be the one club. If people are going to splurge on something, it's probably going to be a, you know, $400 or $500 driver than a, you know, $1,200 set of iron. So, yeah, you know, the differences with this, without, you know, getting too technical, the first one, as you mentioned, they took a CNC milled face insert that they had with F9. And CNC milling is just so people know, is a process that removes the human element out of I would say probably the most inexact part of the driver design process. You know, for the most part, a lot of manufacturers have somebody that you know, machines the bulge and roll onto the face. Now these guys have been doing this process for years. They can do it, but you know, not every face is going to be exact. You're going to have faces that are going to get thrown away because they don't match the exacting standards that some of the other manufacturers have. So Cobra, by going to a CNC milling process, they're able to add that precision and efficiency to the driver design. And this is something that they started doing with F8, has continued to F9 and now into Speed Zone. Now the difference between the previous products and now is that The latest version has 95% more face milling. Now that's, you know, it sounds like a lot. It doesn't look like it. I would say, Tim, when you look at the product, because it really only now wraps into the toe and heel sections. You know, and that benefit is twofold. It increases your discretionary weight. And I, you know, that's a buzzword that I use a lot. Discretionary weight is weight that you're able to move from certain areas within the head, reposition it to most of the time it's to up the forgiveness, increase the launch, help with the overall stability of the head. In this process, it also, you know, expanding that CNC milling on the face is going to give you faster ball speeds. I also noticed, and I wasn't the only one, that because they're now milling that kind of that edge along the top where the crown is, it actually helps with alignment. I found that those milling lines, and I don't know, Tim, I mean, you've seen the driver now, but yeah, when I set it down, those milling lines kind of helped me square up the face at address. So
they definitely frame the ball well.
They do. I feel like they do.
They frame the ball well. It's a cool look, you know, the milling marks that kind of extend beyond just the, I guess you'd call it the top line of the driver, kind of bleeding into the crown. The other really amazing thing was the sound. You know,
yes.
You're not going to hit a Cobra driver that has a poor sound. It has, I would say, a more muted sound compared to some products, but muted in a good way. And then, you know, just the overall shaping of the head. What we did find, I saw, is that I think that this product is going to fare better for folks in the average to higher swing speeds. You know, it tends to be a product that controls spin very well. And so for folks that need a lot of spin, they'll have to either loft up and play a loft that's a little bit higher than they're used to.
Well, they have a 10 and a half and a 12 now. So, I mean, you can go all the way up to 12 degrees
great.
Of that head. Yeah.
And then you can also adjust, obviously. They have their fitting sleeve system that allows for further adjustment, whereby you can raise the loft plus or minus, raise or lower the loft plus or minus 1.5 degrees from whatever the stamped loft is on the face. So the other thing that I noticed, and, you know, this will come out in club test, is relative to all the other products that we tested, when you started hitting balls on different parts of the face, we saw very small deltas in both products.
We did.
That the ball speeds didn't drop off that far. The spin rates didn't change that tremendously. When you looked at the ball flight characteristics as far as dispersion downrange, you know, a low heel hit, a high toe hit, a center faced hit, we saw a much tighter pattern out of all three of those relative to one another than we saw out of many other products. So,
yeah,
you know,
which
not
is
only
important.
Are you getting...
That's really important for the important. Recreational golfer out there who doesn't consistently hit the center of the face. If you're able to get, you know, similar ball speed, if you're hitting it off the heel or the toe, I mean, that is huge. And I think that was the big takeaway for me with this product was, you know, yeah, it looks cool. It looks like it looks like a Ferrari. I pick up this golf club and it, you know, I want to swing it fast because it has that bright yellow and red.
You saw what they did for their launch event, right,
oh,
Jonathan?
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
It was.
Tell
really...
folks a little bit about that. It was
well,
pretty neat.
I know. Unfortunately, I was out conducting player testing that week, but they gave people the opportunity to ride around in a Ferrari on the racetrack, which I would have killed to do because that's not something that you can just go out and do on a regular basis. So yeah, I thought it was a nice tie-in to the overall look and feel that club, the fact that they're trying to make it faster to be able to give people the opportunity to really go as fast as they want.
Yep. So, you know, for all you folks out there that haven't tried a Cobra driver, if you're in the market for a driver in the next, you know, in the next product line lineup that comes out here soon for 2020, definitely suggest giving Cobra a shot
for sure. No,
you won't be. I know that you won't be disappointed. So
yeah, no. And a couple other things on this driver, Tim, that I want to highlight just, it has what they're calling a T-bar speed chassis. You know, you can't see it when you look at the golf club at address, but there is a thin strip of titanium running from the top of the crown to the back of the head. Now, if you were to remove the carbon fiber that they added into these sections, it would look like it's not a really sturdy design, but they said that it can hold up to high-speed collisions with the best of them. Those sections where they removed the titanium, they have added in lightweight carbon fiber that now wraps into the crown and to the sole. It gave him a discretionary weight savings of 25 grams, which is a lot of weight. Now, the head is now 50% made of carbon fiber, which, I mean, when you think about where we were with carbon fiber, it was a really big deal when it was just the crown. Now they're able to start wrapping it into the sole as well. So that's where you get that great sound, but also you're going to be getting that weight savings where you're going to be able to up the forgiveness. And the other thing I just wanted to point out, you know, this club comes in two versions. You know, people today are going to see the King Speed Zone. That's what I would consider to be the standard version. It has two weights in the sole. And depending on where you put that 14-gram weight and that 2-gram weight, if you put the 14-gram weight closer to the face, you're going to get lower launch and spin. If you put the 14-gram weight towards the back of the head, you're going to get a higher launch, more spin, and a touch more forgiveness. But they also have a Speed Zone Extreme version. It's going to be a little bit longer front to back. And that head is going to have a dedicated weight located in the back. So not as much adjustability as the standard version, but again, this is all about ball speed and forgiveness. So if you're the kind of guy that doesn't really want to mess with the weights, you're not looking for low spin, low launch, it's a great option out there. So I think that's one of the things. Also, one other thing that I want to point out with this, which for me is a big deal. In the past, you know, drivers were only offered in one crown version, which was a high gloss. And depending on where you play, you know, get a little bit of glare on that crown, and it can make things a little bit difficult on a really sunny day. They actually now have a matte black version that's going to help reduce some of that glare. So a lot of cool features, I think, with this driver. They also have what they're calling a tour length, which is 44 and a half inches. That's kind of, it was inspired by Ricky Fowler's 43 and a half. And it's going to, you know, give you a tighter dispersion, maybe a little bit less distance, but not noticeable enough for people to want to go with that 45 and
hey,
a half.
Hey, Tony Finau hits it. Tony Finau generates more speed and hits it longer with a shorter shaft.
We've talked about that before, you know. So anyway, this driver, I feel like it has a multitude of options. It's a great menu for golfers out there. And again, look, even if it didn't, I still think this is a great product. But the fact that they were able to take a lot of their previous tech and then kind of build upon it, that seems to be one of the difficult things when manufacturers find something that they really like, is how long do you keep that in the lineup and keep it fresh? And I think Cobra has done that with this product, particularly with that CNC milled face, really now wrapping it into the crown and into the sole. They're able to do it in a really smart way that I think people are going to appreciate.
And with that, I think it would be good to get into our mailbag for the week. You had a couple questions on social, Jonathan. What do you got for us?
Yep. So the first one came from Rob Tom Sick on Twitter, and he wanted to know, what is the best way to find the correct club length? Is it measurement, lie board, swing type, or combination? And this question was asked to me based on the story that from the interview actually that you did with George Gankus, where he mentioned that kind of through working with Matthew Wolf, the within the last like 6 to 7 months, he noticed that Matthew had gone to a shaft length that was an inch shorter, or roughly an inch shorter than what they had been using before. And I think that got people wondering, you know, is there a correct club length out there?
So there are a few different ways to do this, but first and foremost, the good old lie board. You know, in the past we used lie boards for many different reasons. One, most primarily to determine the lie of the golf club. What I now say, with the emergence of other technologies and other fitting processes and methods, the lie board is good for one thing, and that is it is something that will lie to you. That's why they call it a lie board. So I don't use them. I don't think anybody should be using lie boards. It's kind of something that we have to use if we don't have other tools available to us. The lie board isn't really going to tell us much about length anyways. That's going to tell us about club delivery as far as whether the heel or the toe is digging. But as I just mentioned, it doesn't really do a great job of that either. When we're talking about the correct club length, and what I'm about to say would apply to a player that's not currently involved in an instruction program, you know, where they're working on things and lessons with a pro. The first thing is a static measurement, and that's very much, you know, the way that it's been done for quite a long time, which is, okay, how tall is the player? How long are their arms? what is the ratio of arm length to their height? And then what is their general address position? Are they somebody that has a lot of knee bend and crouches over and bends from the hips, or do they stand a little bit taller? That's all going to contribute to a static measurement of how the length should match up. In general, you know, a lot of it has to do with a player's height and arm length, and then making sure that they're in the address position that is proper for their mechanics. So if you're a taller person that may not have abnormally long arms, you're going to fit into something longer than standard. That being said, if you are a taller person that has very, very long arms, you know, a lot of NBA players don't fit in clubs that are as... Yeah, exactly. So you have long arms, but you're also a tall dude.
Yeah.
You play standard length golf clubs. When you fit with us a few weeks back, or I guess it's been months at this point, we tried you in some shafts that were longer than standard, and you hit some pretty dreadful shots with them. So
thank you.
You know, you're very welcome. So not just because you're taller does not mean you automatically go with longer. And conversely, just because you may not be shorter statured doesn't mean you go with a shorter length club either. I have fit plenty of players that were, you know, under the height of 5'10", 5'9", but they had abnormally short arms as well. And that combination of arm length to height is really what's going to dial in the static length of the golf club. But then from there, it's important to understand that you also have to consider this dynamically. And so the way to do that is basically the strike area on the face. You start off with a club, testing a club at the what appears to be the right static length based upon your height and arm length. And then you see where the ball strikes on the face. If the ball is striking low towards the leading edge and out on the toe, then it's advised to try a shaft that's a little bit longer and see if that moves the strike point. If the ball is striking, you know, in on the heel and the mishit tendency is for heavy shots, then it would be advised to try something that's a little bit shorter. Now, I say all of this with one caveat here, which is if you are seeing a pro, it's important for that professional to have some input here. Just like what we spoke about with George Gankus. He specifically believes in a swing protocol and a swing method, you know, mechanics, that the player is turning really aggressively through the shot and keeping their lower section back. You know, when the pelvis moves towards the ball in the downswing, that's called early extension. And he doesn't allow for his players to make a golf swing where they early extend. He wants to keep their pelvis back and turning aggressively through impact. So their body largely is moving away from the ball as they turn through. That's the reason that he specifically likes longer length clubs. He likes a longer length club, especially relative to standard, because it's going to promote for that player to stand back or get away from the ball as they turn through. If you give somebody a longer golf club and they move their pelvis towards the ball, they're going to hit the dreaded shank, or they're going to hit the ball at least in on the neck of the club. So having a longer than normal length club is going to promote staying away from the ball and turning away from the ball on the through swing. Not all teachers teach this. So if it's somebody that isn't necessarily teaching something like this, that's going to affect the fitting. And that was the biggest takeaway from George's interview last week, was that what you're working on instructionally is going to have an impact over the concept of the way that you're fit for clubs. So if you are thinking about getting fit for clubs, involve your instructor. Make sure that the instructor and the club fitter have a conversation, just so that the club fitter can understand what the goal of the instructor is and not end up undermining the instruction by suggesting a club that's not going to work with whatever the player's working on. So,
amen. And listen, Tim, and this kind of goes to something that people have been asking me recently, and I don't know if you get this question a lot, but people will say, look, I don't have the money to spend on a club fitting. Give me some hacks here to get through it. And typically I tell them, look, getting fit is the most important thing you are ever going to do when it comes to your equipment. And here's why. If you get fit correctly, let's say you're working with an instructor, let's say you're not and you just work with a fitter, and you get everything dialed in correctly, you're going to have a lot more success and a lot more longevity with that current equipment setup than you would at any other time in your career. Well, that's going to save you money because you're not going to have to go out and consistently buy a new set of irons or find a new driver because you can't keep it on the map. So sometimes it pays to just spend the money to get properly fit, because in the long run, you're going to have a set of clubs that are going to last you a lot longer, and your dollars is going to stretch a lot farther.
They're one of our technology partners that we work with. We work with multiple different technology partners, from TrackMan and Foresight to SAM to Quintech to Capto. So there are quite a few different technology partners that we have. And one of our technology partners, which I would say is one of the leaders in the space, has a concept for doing a study, and they're calling it the Indian or the Arrow study. And so they've reached out, and they're interested in conducting a study in collaboration with TruSpec, whereby they take a pool of players and send that pool of players through instruction and see over a 30-day period how their handicap index evolves.
Oh, God, I love this.
And then they send another pool of players in to get fit, and they see how that handicap index evolves. And then they take pool A that was instruction-based, and they send them over to the fitters after 30 days, and then vice versa. We're still at the very beginning phases of trying to figure out how to best conduct this study, but man, I think that will be very telling when folks see the efficacy of club fitting, especially in the short term. You know, over the long term, working on your golf swing, if you have the time and the means and the energy and the skill set to be able to do it, obviously improving your mechanics and improving your methods and the way that you swing and all that good stuff is going to have a huge impact over your game. What I always tell folks, if you're looking for that immediate bang for your buck and you want to start playing better today, club fitting is definitely the way to go. With instruction, a lot of time there's a period of regression, and sometimes that regression is unacceptable to different players. So, you know, just going back to the importance of getting fit, answering, you know, Rob Tom Sick here on Twitter, what's the best way to find the correct club length? I guess the real answer is go see a club fitter. But yeah, if you don't have access to one, there are some pieces of advice we can give you. But we have another mailbag question for the week that was sent to you on Instagram, I believe. Right, Jonathan?
Yep. So this one comes from Simon Bird, who asked me on Instagram. He says, I have an Odyssey Stroke Lab 7S putter, and this is a toe hang mallet. It has the standard grip on it currently, and I want to swap it to a two thumb grip. Will the new grip weight have a major effect on feel? If so, what would I likely expect? He said that the standard grip on my putter currently is 65 grams. The original two thumb is 190 grams, but they do a light version of 67, which would pretty much match up. Tim, what do you think? You're the putter guy here.
Well, this is perfect time to answer the question, considering that our interview subject for the week is David Orr. David and I have done a lot of digging when it comes to putter grip. It's something that I brought to his attention a couple years back, that changing a putter grip can radically change the way that the putter performs and the way a player actually makes a putting stroke. And not conventionally, according to what most information is out there these days. Well, for first and foremost, if Simon goes from a 65-gram grip to a 190-gram grip, that's going to radically alter swing weighting. Swing weighting is something that gives the player a sense of where the club face is. For putters, club face angle at impact is absolutely the most important metric at the moment of impact. You cannot make a putt if you don't square your face towards your target. Well, if a player is losing face awareness, and that's what I would guess would happen here if they go to 190-gram grip, because what that's going to do is it's going to reduce the swing weighting significantly. I'm talking this putter could end up being reduced by 20 points or somewhere thereof in swing weighting, maybe even more. So if they're going from a, you know, D8 or D9 swing weight in their putter, and now they're in the B range, maybe even upper A range, that's going to radically alter the way that the club face feels during the putting stroke. Now, the player mentioned here that they do have a light version at 67 grams. I would highly encourage Simon to go with that direction rather than go with the 190 gram range.
Yeah. You don't want, I'm with you. You don't want to make a drastic change like that. Just go with something that's pretty close, especially if
it's pretty close.
Yeah. Right. Same grip design, lighter weight, pretty similar to what you were using. Yeah. Just go that route.
Now, the next part that I would make on this is by going to this two thumb grip, and this two thumb grip is a specific grip where you kind of put your hands alongside of one another. So instead of you have left hand low and then you have conventional, where one hand is placed higher than the other on the grip, depending upon which method. The two thumb method, you kind of put your hands at the same place on the grip, opposing one another, and then kind of line your thumbs up right next to each other. This is going to radically change your stroke dynamics. As to how, I can't answer that question. It's different from one player to the next. But suffice to say that whatever your tendencies were before, there's a good chance that your tendencies will change, and they could change radically. The biggest thing that I would encourage Simon to do is, if he's making this change, see if there's somebody nearby that's either a fitter or an instructor that has access to technology, and see what the difference is. Specifically, see what the difference is in club face at impact and the consistency of club face at impact. If your club face is coming in more square and it's doing so more consistently, then I'm all for it. Make the change. If the club face is not coming in more consistently square and the variation from stroke to stroke is broader or wider, this is probably not a good idea. So I can't stress the importance enough. Obviously, look and feel is really important with putters, but at the end of the day, the ball rolls where it rolls, not because of look or feel, but because of physics. And something that we do at TruSpec is we use quantitative analysis tools like launch monitors and different inertial sensors to measure what's going on with the putter. It's so important to have some measuring stick to be able to determine what's actually happening and give feedback beyond just look and feel. Obviously, the player has to like the way that a putter looks and feels, but the ball doesn't care how the putter looks and feels. The only thing the ball cares is that the club face is square, that the ball was struck solidly, and that the ball was launched and spinning off the face properly. So I can't stress this enough. Make some sort of technology a piece of what you do when you're considering different putter changes. I know that your scorecard will definitely thank you for it. And with that, I think it's a perfect segue to get into part one of our David Orr interview. David Orr runs Flatstick Academy out of Pine Needles in North Carolina, has worked with a multitude of PGA and LPGA Tour players. David was also one of the lead researchers with the David Adell putter fitting system. There's really nobody better to speak to on the planet regarding putters. I would put he and Phil Kenyon at the top of the list. And without further delay, here's part one. We are glad to have David Orr, the world famous David Orr putting savant, onto Fully Equipped. A few weeks back, David, we asked all of our listeners who's the one person they wanted on the podcast. We got a few requests for Tiger, but you out earned Tiger in requests, almost 2-1. So more requested than Tiger Woods. Here we are, David Orr.
Thanks, Tim.
So we want to talk. Yeah, 100%, man.
No way.
I wouldn't make it up. So we want to talk, putters. Obviously you are, you and Phil Kenyon are widely considered to be the putting gurus,
for now, right?
But, we've had the pleasure of working together for a little while now. And, I know at first we met a few years back at an Andrew Rice coach camp, 2 o'clock in the morning grind session on putting at a local bar in Savannah. It's been a great few years ever since.
Good cocktails, and it's a family affair with my stepson Jake working with
TruSpec. That's right. Yeah, that's right.
And I am so grateful to be with TruSpec because it's just an amazing company, brand agnostic.
Yep.
And it's unbelievable to have such a great partnership.
Yeah. So, I think a lot of our listeners out there, you've specialized in putters and in putting. Now, for all our folks that are listening, David is an amazing golf instructor. You know as much about the golf swing as anybody. You're fantastic about teaching and coaching wedges as well. You know how to teach how to play. But you've made a not, you've 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 selected putters as kind of your calling. I'd be curious to know how you got into putters specifically.
Well, I mean, obviously we all play the mini tours, and I sucked at putting, and you know, bought a bunch of putters. I mean, I've owned a 100 or so.
Yeah.
Every ping that ever came
out. I'd love to see your collection sometime.
Yeah, it's actually
I've never seen it.
You have actually reduced it.
Because your tour players keep stealing them on you.
Yeah, or I steal circle tees from them. So anyway, but no, I was, to me, I always felt like the putter was an issue.
Right.
As a player.
Personally.
Personally, yeah. And you know, everybody said I had a great stroke, but I didn't make anything.
Man, does that sound familiar?
You know what I'm saying? Oh, you got a great stroke. It's beautiful. It's not your stroke. It's all in your head.
Right.
Well, if it was all in my head, then, you know, why couldn't I putt better? So, you know, I've been teaching golf for 28 years. I taught full swing. I was a, you know, golf machine instructor, a Mac O'Grady guy, Andy Plummer, Mike Bennett, all good friends. And I got into putting because Billy McDonald from HG, Henry Griffiths, gave me a fit-to-aim system, putter fitting system. And it was a bunch of heads, bunch of hosels, and a line template. And on the face, it said Adele, Adele Design. I'm like, who's Adele? And Billy McDonald said, that's David Adele. He's an up-and-comer, makes great equipment. He makes all the heads. So I called David Adele up, and I said, David, this is David Orr. I'm at Campbell University PGA Golf Management in Buies Creek. I said, would you mind coming up and speaking to our kids about putter fitting?
Right.
And it was one of the new things in the industry was putter fitting. And he came up and brought his classical system up. Which
How many years ago is this at this point?
This is 2000.
I don't want to date you, but.
Six or seven.
Yeah, so.
Seven.
13, 14 years.
Yeah, so anyway, he said, hey, you guys got 170 kids in this program. Would you be willing to do some research for me? And I was like, yeah, well, what do you want us to do? He goes, I want you to check everybody's aim with different heads.
Right.
You know, the blade versus mallet, and then hosels, like L hosel, which was a plumber's neck, and then a flow neck, which was an S hosel, and then different line configurations. And so we ran the kids through just laser tests.
Right.
And then also on Sam Putlab.
Checking how they aim.
Yeah, just checking how they aim visually.
And so the shaping of the putter head, the alignment package, whether it's dots, lines, multiple lines.
Right. And then what we did was David invited me to present with him at Better Golf Through Technology at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in both 2007, 2008. And the first year we talked about aim. The second year we talked about how aim, where people aim their stroke.
Right.
You know what I mean?
We'll talk about that in just a minute.
Grandpa's gun, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so that's how I got started in it. And then I became an Adele fitter, and then obviously had Sam Putlab, and it's collecting a lot of strokes, and started to notice that when I go out on a tour that there are a lot of method teachers out there.
Right.
You know, stay connected or keep the back of the left hand of the hole. And I've been looking at Sam data, and I'm sitting there going, nobody has the same move anyway.
Right.
So how can you teach everybody to do the same thing when, you know, you might be blocking it, and you're pulling it, and you're leaving putts short. And so I just kind of noticed that if I treated the person as an individual and fixed what they needed to be fixed, as opposed to teaching them some method that I came up with in my mind that, you know, that, okay, you should putt with your shoulders or your big muscles or whatever. But, and then it evolved into not just stroke research on the putter and then on the putting stroke, but then I got hooked up with Dr. Rob Neal in 2012, 2013, and got the GBD 8 sensor system and a 3D system and started measuring what people actually do.
Motion capture, the way that they're actually moving
actually
their putter.
Actually measuring people.
Right.
Good players. And measuring what they do with their wrists.
How eye-opening was that?
That was career-changing. That was life-changing for me when I sit there and go, wait a minute, everybody's telling us to putt with our shoulders, straight back, straight through.
Pretty hard to do, actually.
And yes, I mean, there's a lot of there's movement at the shoulder, but there's also micro moves in the elbows and in the wrists, which create a stroke signature, as Christian Marquardt likes to call it. So everybody has their own little stroke signature or stroke pattern. And then I started to look at the wrist sequencing.
Right.
And I'm sitting there going, oh my gosh, players that de-loft it and kind of twist under tend to work a little inside out or inside down the line.
Right.
Where they lose the toe in the backswing and then they under twist with their trail hand cutting across it. They started looking at what the hands are doing and then what the forearms are doing. And I'm sitting here going, nobody is looking at it this way. They're just looking at it as, should I use a line on the ball or not?
Yep.
Or should I use face balance or toe hang? Or do you teach straight back, straight through, or arc putting? It's almost like the world that I'm in, Tim,
yeah,
is what people are actually doing, and everybody's over here in la-la land still trying to figure out whether they should use a line.
All right, so I want to get back into gear, but I have to ask this question. Give me your three biggest putting fallacies.
First of all, putters don't move in a straight line, period. End of
story. So the idea of straight back, straight through.
Well, that's an arc in a vertical plane.
Right.
Okay, so straight back, straight through is an arc.
Putter fallacy number one, the putter does not move in a straight line.
Period.
Yeah. Have you ever seen a single player that even came close?
I've seen people try. And they become very wristy and armsy because they're changing the radius of the club.
Right.
In the backswing and then back to impact through the ball. So you see they're trying to go straight back, straight through, but that belief system's causing them to be wristy and armsy.
Right. And so now putter fallacy number two.
Oh, you put me on the spot now. That was one, right?
Yeah.
But that it's a perfect pendulum.
Yeah, I love that. I love getting you fired up in these presentations.
I'm not even going to go there. But, you know, it has angular motion, but the center is not, it's not a fixed radius and it's not a perfect center.
Right.
There is translation of the butt of the club. And
right. Which is why a putting robot is not really a great tool to be able to measure what's going on with the putter.
No, I think, you know where a robot's place is testing putters, maybe like toe strikes, heel strikes, testing different lofts. I mean, I used a robot, I'm trying to think of his name. It'll come back to me. I'm showing my age there. Iron Archie. They sent me Iron Archie, and we used him for a little bit. And we did that to test loft and roll out and all that kind of stuff. But it's the human that's 1 degree of freedom.
Right.
But a human being has seven employees on the left side of their body and seven on the right side of their body. It's more coordination.
Right.
And that's what I see with putting strokes. It's how you coordinate the stroke, but also how coordinated you are.
Right.
You know, and we start talking about putters.
Yeah, matching up the implement to what the player's actually doing and what they're capable of doing.
It's funny, the industry is making putters heavier.
Yep.
The industry's making bigger grips and more weight, more mass. And what's interesting is they're creating sledgehammers.
Yep.
And
so they're trying to tap nails in the wall to hang a picture with a sledgehammer.
Exactly.
Yeah,
I mean, you can do it. So, but what's interesting, you know, we talked about this earlier. You know, look at the weight of the putters and the grips that are used by the best putters in the game.
Very light. They've got a little flexion in the shaft.
Yeah, Tiger Woods, I think.
335 grams with a ping grip, you know, a skinny ping pistol grip with a fairly lightweight shaft.
Yeah.
Faxon is not using something that's...
Crenshaw.
Yep.
You know, I think maybe Lauren Roberts might be the only person I think that's a top 10 putter that used a heavier putter. But if you look at his motion, there was a lot of rocking,
yes,
and very little rotation,
yep,
in the stroke. So I think the industry is going one way,
yep,
and putting instructions going the other way.
Can I add the third putting fallacy?
Yeah, go for it.
Put your eyes over the ball.
Eyes over the ball is not a fundamental. You had an interesting stat. You said
87% of all tour professionals measured back when I worked for an OEM. We used motion capture.
A major OEM.
We did some research on all of the different tour players that we worked with. 87% of all tour players did not have their eyes over the ball at address. They were inside of the ball.
Yeah, and then a lot of people, when they interpret eyes over the ball, if they play the ball forward, they move their whole body leaning over the ball to the left. And their spine,
it causes a lot of problems.
Yeah, causes all kinds of problems. So, you know, it's interesting. Putting instruction is going through an enlightenment period.
Yep.
You know, it's coming out of the dark ages and into the enlightenment of, oh, wait a minute, people, you know, they don't have their eyes over the ball. They're not moving the putter straight back, straight through. And, you know,
it's not moving in a pendulum.
Yeah, rock the baby. And
This stuff is out the window.
Yeah, so it's, you're going to start seeing a major shift in putting instruction and teaching people to be skillful.
Yep.
Read greens better. We see that with Aimpoint. Become better touch on the greens, better technique. And what's interesting, I had Christian Marquardt here last week, and he says, I got new SAM data for the tour. And I said, I don't want that data. And he goes, why? I said, because ever since you brought your product into the market, people's strokes have gotten better. I want the old data before there was anybody ever measured.
Right.
And he goes, I never thought of that.
Yep.
You know, I said, I want...
Makes a lot of sense.
Exactly.
Actually.
I said, so Sam Putt Lab and Physio putting templates and well putt templates and, you know, Capto and Blast, you know, people's strokes have gotten better.
Yep.
Because of technology. And that's another interesting conversation. You can have a world-class putting stroke and not be able to putt.
Yep.
And I see that quite a bit, especially with mini tour players and elite players come in to see me. They go, you got to fix my stroke. And I throw them on technology. I said, man, your stroke's good enough to win a major. And they look at it, and I'm like, we need to go talk about making putts.
Yep.
And get you in the right frame of mind. So.
And in some cases, get them in the right putter.
Yeah, and let's talk a little bit more about that if you want to.
Yeah, so, you know, you did some groundbreaking research with David Adell and looking into the optics of putting. And, you know, I think that that's really one of the foundational building blocks of fitting putters, is starting out with what is the concept, and then also how is somebody actually visualizing, and then what is the optimal address position that they can visualize from. And then that's going to determine the length and the lie angle, as well as with the arm, you know, in conjunction with the arm.
Starting with your individual perception.
Exactly right. Yes. And so when you're looking at some of the research you did about the head shaping, the alignment package, as we like to call it, whether you're using a dot on the putter, whether you're using lines, all this stuff can move the needle in a big way as far as the way somebody's aiming their putter.
Well, Golf Magazine, I believe, wrote a book called The Greatest Putting Book Ever, wasn't it?
Right.
Something like that. And a lot of the stuff with David and myself and was published in there. And, you know, basically blades move the knob to the left.
Yep.
And mallet
more pull based. So yeah. when you look at the trailing edge of a putter, yeah. If it's more angular and perpendicular to the line, I say, you know, fitting's about turning knobs and levers, right? And so when you go with a perpendicular trailing edge to the target line, that's going to turn that knob more to the pull side.
Yeah, yep. A little left bias. And then,
how about lines?
Lines on the back a little bit. But it varied. You know, it wasn't always 100% true. But there was a strong tendency that for people with lines on the back tend to aim more left.
And then what about neck style when you go into like a plumber's neck?
So, yeah. So let's just go. Let's go classic ready. Let's go a Newport, line on the back, plumber's neck.
We got all the knobs are left.
Left.
Yep.
Right. So
this is for somebody that aims to the right.
Yeah. Or strokes a little bit inside out or down the line.
Yep.
You know, like T-dubs, right?
So let's talk about that really quickly. So the idea that somebody needs to be aimed at zero in order to be a good putter.
Oh, you don't have to be. I mean, some people. So, I mean, let me give you a choice. Ready? A, you can aim at the target, but then you never return the face.
Right.
Or you aim a little right of the target and you return the face all the time.
Which would you rather?
That's grandpa's gun, right?
I'd rather option B.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when we're talking about option B, one of the best putters of all time aims his putter 2.5 degrees right of the target line, which from 10 feet is well outside the hole.
Yeah, absolutely. And then plays a little release.
And then plays the release in the putter, and the putter face comes back a little bit closed relative to center.
Exactly.
So he's changing the face from 2.5 degrees open to slightly closed at the moment of impact. Oh, by the way, the person that we're speaking of here is Tiger Woods.
Yeah, and he's probably one of the greatest putters of all time. And
so this idea
is intentional.
Right, and it's intentional. Yeah, so
he's aiming his stroke.
He knows that he closes the face, so he's trying to aim it a little bit more on the push side or open side in order to allow for that.
Yeah, so we've talked about two components of aim here. We've talked first about visual perception of the line and also the putter itself. And then we have to talk about aiming the stroke. And I told the story about when I was in Germany.
Oh, man.
About Grandpa's gun, right?
Yep.
And, you know, Grandpa's gun, you take it out of the closet, you're going hunting, hasn't been sighted in, it shoots, you know, a degree and a half to the right. Where are you going to aim? You're going to aim a degree and a half to the left.
Yep.
You know, or, you know, in Tiger's case, there's a little release to the stroke, and, you know, it tends to be a little bit of closing or pulling, so he aims to the right. And we saw that with Cordy out here with a little fitting system. So people start to aim their stroke tendencies a little bit.
Now we know with Tiger, he's got a plumber's neck. He's got a perpendicular trailing edge to the to the line with his putter. He does use a sight dot, so that's a little bit more to the turning the knob a little bit more to the push side of the alignment.
Yeah, exactly. So it goes more to the face, the front part, aiming the face, the perpendicular of the face. I call it dot in the eye. There's a line on the ball, and there's a dot on the putter. Yep. And but here's the thing about it. I mean, you know, I guarantee you, if I brought a laser in here, Tiger could aim it.
Right.
I guarantee you. So I don't think he's aiming to the right because he's a bad aimer. I think he aims it because of his pattern.
Right.
And likes the feel of that toe flowing and the ball rolling early and, you know, a good launch on the...
There's a lot of face rotation in a stroke, too.
There's a tremendous amount of
rotation. More, you know, if you look at his Sam... If you look at how Sam Putlab grades him on face rotation... They grade him very poorly, but the consistency factor.
Well, I told Christian, I don't like the grading.
Right.
You know, just understand that he has very little arc, but he has lots of rotation or twisting.
Right.
Along the plane of the stroke. So, It puts a beautiful release on the putter and a beautiful roll on the ball. Great energy.
But he does it the same way.
Yeah, that's the
every
key thing.
Every single time.
Yeah, he could work at McDonald's drive-thru with a cheeseburger line. I mean, he makes the same cheeseburger every time. You know, he could. So, but, you know, here's the thing, too. And, you know, you look at Tiger's stroke and you look at Brad Faxon's stroke.
Yep.
And you look at Stan Utley's stroke. These players had rotation.
Yep.
They didn't have low rotation. They had medium to more rotation. So, and that comes from mainly we talk about a little bit the hands and the forearms.
Yep.
And I call it the lower Y when you're putting with the forearms and the shaft.
Right.
They form a Y. And when you feel it more in your hands and form, you're going to get a little more loading, a little more releasing.
Right.
You know, as opposed to putting with the big Y, which is up here in the shoulders and you're rocking them, you
right.
get a little less rotation. And so, you know, it's interesting. The best putters of all time used rotation.
Right.
That helped them be skillful as opposed to you see the industry, oh, we got to get high OMOI putter, big grip, heavy yep. shaft. Let's keep this putter from rotating.
Yeah.
All right, we want to thank David again for his time and insight. Look for part two of the interview next week. That'll do it for episode 19 of Fully Equipped. Make sure you keep up with us on Twitter and Instagram. We've always got all kinds of fun content on there. Tim's at Club Whisper on Twitter and at Tim_Breon78 on Instagram. I'm at Jonathan Wall on both platforms. We appreciate you taking the time to listen. We'll see you around.